When you think of fairy tales, you think probably of Snow White and Cinderella and, on the more gnarly side, Rumpelstiltskin. The retelling of the old Grimm's fairy tales go much further into that gnarly side in the hands of Adam Gidwitz. He put together a trilogy of Grimm stories, grim in both senses of the word, and the trilogy is now complete. A Tale Dark and Grim and In a Glass Grimly are now joined by The Grim Conclusion. It contains delightful tales involving millstones, murder, cannibalism, and, of course, cheerful little birds singing delightful songs of murder and cannibalism and so forth. Adam Gidwitz is a teacher who spent 8 years of his life teaching in Brooklyn. Now he's a full-time writer and our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Love the description in your bio about what being a writer means.
Being a writer, for me, is just just playing with these crazy old stories and scaring children along the way, if I can, also making them laugh.
What grade level did you teach when you taught?
Well, I taught a bunch of grade levels. I taught first grade, second grade, fifth grade, and high school at various times, all in Brooklyn. And it was exciting to get to jump back and forth between those different age groups and practice storytelling with all of them.
So it's really been the storytelling part of it. It sounds like that's always motivated you to get in front of groups of kids.
I started out as a teacher, but it turned out when I started that I wasn't actually a very good teacher, because the one thing that you have to do as a teacher before you can teach kids anything is get them to be quiet for like 1 minute, and I did not know how to do that. I had a crazy class full of kids who were like running around and chasing each other with blocks and gluing stuff to their face, and I couldn't ever get them to calm down. Until one day I decided I couldn't take it anymore, and I sat down in the middle of the rug. I remember this day still clearly, and I said, forget you kids, I'm just going to tell a story. And four kids came up and sat next to me, because in every classroom there are always like four nice children who will help out the teacher no matter how bad that teacher is. So the four nice kids sat next to me, and I said, once upon a time. And as soon as I said that, the strangest thing happened. All of the kids, even the bad ones, came and started to crowd towards the rug. It was a really magical thing to see happen. And over the course of the story, I got all of the kids' attention, and it turned out that was the one way that I had of really getting kids to listen to me, and I started doing it all the time. So storytelling became the way that I communicated with children.
Was the storytelling also used as something of an incentive, like, you know, if you guys will work with this math lesson, I'll give you another story?
Yeah, you know, I'm actually not very good at making us do hard work. I was never particularly good at that. So usually it would be like, oh, I forgot to teach math today because we were telling a story.
Mm-hmm.
I literally had parents come in one day and say, wasn't there supposed to be homework this week? And I said, oh, right, I forgot.
So it sounds like departing from teaching wasn't necessarily a hard decision to make.
Well, the opportunity to get to tell more stories to kids was what did it, though the initial departure was quite difficult. I had written a book before these books about ancient Egypt, and I had worked on it over the course of a year, and I decided to leave my job for a year to try to work on it. My wife was not happy about this, because that was our income. That was at least one half of our income. And I worked for a whole year, and I was very proud of it. It was 450 pages long. And I took it to an agent, and she read it, and she invited me to her office in the top of a skyscraper in Manhattan. I was so excited. I was like, oh, I'm big time now. Took the elevator all the way up, and there were windows all about, and I sat in the big comfy chair, and I said, so what did you think? And she said, it's not very good. And I was shocked and devastated. I said, it's not very good. I've been working on it for 2 years. I quit my job. That's 400 pages long. All you can say is it's not. She said, well, if you wanted to start on a different project, I wouldn't blame you, which is publishing speak for throw it in the trash can.
Right. This one's no good. Let's talk about the next one. What else you
got
for
exactly.
Me?
Yeah. Exactly. I was totally devastated. And I was about to give up on the writing thing altogether and just go back to teaching when I got a phone call from my school, and they asked me if I would be willing to be a substitute librarian for a day. And I said yes, because, you know, I wanted to tell stories to kids. Fantastic. They said, you'll be telling stories to second graders. I said, no problem. They said, tell them any story you want. I said, great. So I went home, and I was looking around on my shelf for a good story to read to second graders, and I came across my book of the real Grimm fairy tales. Now, I had never read this book, to be honest. At this time, it had been on my shelf for years and years. I'd never even opened it. So I looked at it, and I thought, oh, fairy tales. Those are perfect for little kids. So I picked up the book and opened it up to a story Faithful Johannes. And in the story Faithful Johannes, two children get their heads cut off by their parents. They get put back on again. They come back to life. But there is a time in there when their parents have decapitated them. And I read it and I thought, huh, that's interesting. Can I read this to second graders? Will I get fired? And then I thought, let's find out. So I brought the book in and I started reading to these kids, and very quickly they became very nervous. So I would make a joke to calm a little bit, or I would warn them when something really terrible was about to happen. And I think I did a pretty good job, because when I looked up at the end of the story, every kid had the same expression on his face. Every kid had his mouth hanging wide open and his eyes wide and his hands clenched together in utter terror. And I was like, oh boy. So some of them left, but a few of them came up to me afterwards and they stuck their little fingers in my face and they said, that was good. I said, what? And they said, you should make that into a book. And that's started me on the path of the Grimm fairy tales.
So when you say your book of the real Grimm fairy tales, I mean, we've just sanitized them and Disneyfied them over the years?
We have, exactly right. So the Brothers Grimm first published their tales in 1812 and then published a bunch of revisions through 1857. And they became immensely popular in Germany and in the UK and in the United States. They were bestsellers. In 1900 in the UK, the Daily Mail said it was one of the five books that every child should own. But when they came to the United States, they got sanitized by one Walt Disney.
All right, much more to talk about here with Adam Gidwitz, who is the author of The Grimm Conclusion, the final book in the three-book trilogy of his reworking of the old Grimm fairy tales, getting the true Grimm back into the Grimm fairy tales. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange when we return from this break, back with Adam Gidwitz and your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening and happy Halloween. We're celebrating Halloween by getting into some tales of the dark and creepy, the Grimm fairy tales, the Brothers Grimm's fairy tales, as retold through the hands of Adam Gidwitz, who was a teacher in Brooklyn for several years and took up the idea of restoring the Grimm fairy tales to what they really had been originally. The third book in his trilogy, the final one, is called The Grimm Conclusion, now out on sale. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. So back to the main point here, which is that the original Grimm Brothers fairy tales were about people losing limbs and heads and lives and stuff like that. And so how those were popular evidently in Europe, if the Grimm Brothers kept reworking them for, what, another 45 years or so?
They were. They were immensely popular. The Grimm Brothers weren't the first ones to take fairy tales and retell them, but they were probably the best. They were real geniuses in their own right. If you're familiar with the Oxford English Dictionary, the great repository of the history of the English language, they invented that idea in Germany and started essentially the German historical dictionary. So they were real visionaries in a lot of fronts, but they collected these fairy tales and they published them and they revised them. So they didn't make them up, of course. They asked various people to send them stories and tell them stories. And Wilhelm, in particular, the younger brother, had a very dark and amusing take on the fairy tales that he would often lace through the tellings. And they have been very popular. And the funny thing is, they are still very popular if you share them with kids. Kids adore these stories. So I go to schools all over the country, probably 100 schools a year. And when I tell these stories, the real Grimm fairy tales, to kids, they scream, they laugh, they give each other high fives. Now, the stories are funny, and I try to make them even funnier by making jokes and giving them warnings, just like I did to those second graders the first time I ever told the story. But they all end happily, which is really important. You know, this is not like watching the evening news. This is a story that takes care of children really well. And when you tell it right, they love them. They are obsessed with them. One of the first school visits I ever did, a young man came up to me. This was in a school, in a Title I school. And he came up to me after I told the story, and he picked up my book, and he said, "This is the first book I'm going to read this year." And when he said that, when I heard that, I said, "You know what? I'm onto something with these real grim fairy tales."
So were the tales, so these are tales that have been compiled through history, so some of them perhaps centuries old, but just more or less compiled by the Grimm brothers. Were they stories that kids told to entertain each other? Were they stories that adults told to the kids as cautionary tales, you know, how not to misbehave because this could happen to you?
Right. That's a common misconception about the cautionary tales. There are grisly German stories that are cautionary. There's a famous collection called Streuelpeter, or Shock-Headed Peter. But the Grimm tales were not. They were entertainment, and they weren't just entertainment for kids. You have to remember, of course, that in 1812 there were no movies, no TV, no radio. How they lived without radio, I don't know, but they did. And what they did was they would gather around at night after the work was done, and they would tell each other stories. And these stories had to be structured in such a way that the children could love them, but that so could, you know, crazy Grandma Gretel or whatever, and Uncle Louie. So they had to be scary and funny and access all parts of the personality and psyche. And they did, and these are the best of them. These are the ones that survived hundreds of years from telling to telling and household to household that the Brothers Grimm collected and immortalized.
The narrator voice in the book, your asides, and they're in bold print, by the way, which is great because then we know it's you talking to us. But, yeah, I mean, you really talk right to the kids. You haven't lost that teacher touch, I see.
Yeah, I did that because after I told that first story to those second graders when they said, you know, make that into a book, I was thinking about how to do that because the story I told them, Faithful Johannes, is already in a book. It's in the Grimm's Fairy Tales. And I thought, how can I make it my own? And I was thinking about it and thinking about it. I remember very clearly one day walking out of the door of my apartment, and I stopped. And I closed the door. I came down. I put the keys on the table. My jacket was still on. I opened my computer, and I started to write. And what I wrote was exactly the story that I told to those kids, with all the jokes, all the comments, all the narrative interjections. I put it right down on a piece of paper. And I sent it back to that same agent who had rejected my first book. And she called me up, and she said, "This is pretty good." And I think that that narrative voice is important because these stories can be scary. And so when I'm warning the kids and making jokes, not only are they laughing or being warned, they're also being reminded that what you're hearing is just a story and it will be okay in the end.
Well, the opening discussion in the narrator voice, raise your hand if you've heard of Hansel and Gretel. Do it. Thanks. Raise your hand if you heard of Rumpelstiltskin. I assume you're raising your hand. Sleeping Beauty, your hand's still up, right? Snow White, of course you have. Cinderella, your hand better still be in the air. But now you're thinking, wait a minute, you said fairy tales used to be grim, i.e. ghastly, repellent, sinister. These stories aren't ghastly, repellent, or sinister at all. They are cute and sweet and boring. Did you get reactions from kids where you could have read, like, the Disney version of Cinderella? It would have been like, yeah, whatever, glass slipper, blah, blah, blah.
And, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I play on that when I visit schools. In fact, that what you just read is directly from what I say to kids when I go to schools, that much of the third and final book is derived from the visits that I do. Because these stories, as you said, were originally oral tales. They were passed along verbally. And I really want to try to keep that voice and that sound. So I would, you know, say, I'm going to tell Cinderella, and the kids would go, aw, and I would say, okay, wait a minute. Do you know the real Cinderella? As you probably know, listeners probably know, too, in the real Grimm Cinderella, first of all, the shoe isn't made of glass. It's made of gold, which is pretty fancy. That's a nice shoe.
Mm-hmm. Heavy.
And yeah, very heavy. Not good for dancing, but very fancy. And the stepsisters, in order to get the glass, the golden shoe to fit, the first one cuts off her big toe. And the second one cuts off, the Grimm brothers say, a chunk of her heel, which is a really wonderful use of that word, of that noun, chunk. Cuts off a chunk of her heel and shoves it into the shoe. And when the kids hear that, there is a combination of horror and hilarity that you just hard to match in any modern story.
I'm just noticing the effect in myself as you tell it that way, with the chunk of the heel going, ugh, but at the same time, I'm laughing. It's just fun.
It is amazing that you, because they are stories and you know that. And I try very much to play on the humor and the horror. When something is scary, if you slide a joke in there, you will laugh three harder at that joke than you would have in another context. And likewise, if things are funny and then it takes a scary turn, it's much scarier. For some reason, humor and horror work really well together.
So, Adam Gidwitz, how much of what appears in The Grimm Conclusion is from the Grimm Brothers, and how much has been twisted a bit by you?
It's a pretty good mix. I would say the first half of the book retells Grimm fairy tales rather faithfully. I add a lot of the jokes. I had to change many of the characters and many of the situations in order to help fit my overarching plot, because it is one big story. But the stories themselves do come from Grimm in the first half of the book. By the second half of the book, I have departed into my own world, and that tends to be the format, the structure of my books, where each chapter still sounds like a fairy tale, but now it's a fairy tale that I have invented. So I really feel like, and in fact, I think on Amazon it even says, written by Adam Gidwitz, Jacob Grimm, and Wilhelm Grimm, as if we're all co-authors together.
With them sitting right by your shoulder as you were typing.
Exactly. We have coffee all the time in Brooklyn, yeah.
Adam Gidwitz is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the author of the books that that bring out the true Grimm nature, the original fairy tales that were delivered to us by the Grimm brothers 2 centuries ago. His latest book is called The Grimm Conclusion. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about fairy tales that have gone heavy on the fairy and light on the gruesome over the years. Join us at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Yorinda and Yoringel, the main characters in The Grimm Conclusion, where'd they come from?
Well, you said their names right, which I'm impressed about. They are original Grimm characters. There is a story called Yorinda and Yoringel. In fact, ironically, it's one of the stories I did not end up using in my book. It's about two young people in love with one another, and Yorinda gets captured by a witch and turned into a bird, and Yoringel has to figure out which one she is. But in the end, there were so many wonderful Grimm fairy tales that I wanted to use in my book, fairy tales like The Juniper Tree and Aschenputtel, also known as Cinderella, and The Boy Who Left Home to Find Fear, that I didn't actually have the space for Yorinda and Yoringel.
You know, I guess when you stop to think about the characters in some of these stories, so many stepfathers and stepmothers and things like that, considering the time in history in which these stories were compiled, a lot of people were dying unexpectedly.
It's true, but in fact, I think historically, when you look at the various editions of the Grimm stories that were published, and there's a wonderful record of what they did. In fact, the first edition that they wrote that we have is from 1810. It was not published, and it was discovered in, I think, 1910 in a monastery in Alsace in eastern France. And it's the very first scribbles that they had made of these stories. And if you follow the revision history of these Grimm fairy tales from 1810 through 1857, when they finally stopped revising them, you'll see that, in fact, many of these parents didn't start out as stepmothers and stepfathers. Many of them started out as mothers and fathers. So in Snow White, which is one of my favorite stories to tell, in the 1810 edition, it is not Snow White's evil stepmother who cannot bear the beauty of her daughter and orders her killed. It is Snow White's mother. And what's really interesting about that, I think, is that these stories speak to deep fears and desires of children as well as adults. I think that every mother and daughter has felt that competition and that jealousy, even for a moment. And Snow White, especially when it's about the mother, it's about the stepmother, takes that feeling of jealousy and blows it up into an enormous, scary, funny, weird story that helps the child feel those emotions and think through them. It's not a coincidence that these stories have stuck around for so many hundreds of years. I think they really do speak to kids' deepest feelings, fears, and needs.
So in a sense, you're really taking what is an honest emotion and blowing it up to something that is caricatured in a sense. So in a way, you can be horrified if that's what the moment demands, or amused by it. You can laugh at it.
Exactly. But it helps you feel those feelings. I mean, a much later tradition from Germany and Austria is Expressionism, right, where you would take a feeling and blow it up on a canvas with a sort of grotesque representation of it. In some ways, these Grimm fairy tales are an early form of Expressionism.
What is the recommended age cutoff for the people to read the Grimm conclusion?
That's a great question.
Either up or down, because, and pardon me for using the word cutoff, because I know that there are some heads that roll in this book.
Right, good point. For my books, I would say, and then I'll talk about the Grimm stories, I have had very brave 6- and 7-year-olds read my books and love them, and I have had 13- and 14-year-olds tell me they were too scary and they had to put them down. It's really important, I think, that we let kids choose what they are ready for, and I think they know. The great thing about a book, unlike a movie, is that it is really easy to close a book. Movies come at you really fast, mm-hmm. and you can see something that you don't want to see before you know what's happened to you. But books are so easy to close. People do it all the time. And I find that kids really know what they are ready for. So everyone has experienced that 2-year-old sitting on your lap, whether it's your 2-year-old or somebody else's, and they want to read the same book over and over and over again. And that is because there is something in that book that the kid wants to learn, wants to master. And then suddenly, one day, you'll present the favorite book, and they'll discard it as if they've never want to see it again. And I think that's because they know the book, and they've learned the lesson, and they're ready to move on. So I think kids do the same thing throughout their reading lives, where if you put one of my books in a kid's hand, and they read the first chapter, they'll either say, I love this, I want to read every book that he's ever written, or they may very well say, I don't want to read this right now. I'm not ready for this right now. And I think we have to listen to our kids when they say that because they know what they need. The same thing probably goes for the Grimm fairy tales. I have told some of the bloodiest Grimm fairy tales to 5- and 6-year-olds and seen them enraptured. And I've seen 8-year-olds run to the back of the bookstore when I was telling the story and sit in their mom's lap because they weren't ready to hear the story.
Well, and then there's the other end of the age spectrum, and you write in the book, adults, you should not read any further. So you must have gotten a fair amount of feedback from parents along the way, too.
I have, and adults tend to be more nervous about these things than kids are. I think they are worried for their kids, and I think adults have every right and responsibility to care for their kids and watch out for them and make sure that they are not super upset or traumatized. And I think that there's something funny about the fact that we've lived longer and we've experienced more horrible things in reality, that when we read about them, they have sort of real-world resonances that they do not have for children. Children are able to suspend their disbelief so much more easily than we are. If I say once upon a time, I can tell a kid almost anything because he knows it will end with happily ever after. Parents and adults don't seem quite so malleable in that way.
That's interesting. We've lost our childlike ability to be flexible and imagine things like heads rolling off and then getting put back on.
I think that's exactly it.
So in addition to hearing from parents and kids, I have to wonder if you've got any calls from maybe the legal department at Disney about some of the statements about Cinderella being boring, for example.
Well, to be very honest, I still love the Disney Cinderella. And I'm not just saying that out of fear of litigation. I could sing you all the songs right now, but if I sing singing the Cinderella song, you probably wouldn't appreciate it. But I love those movies, and they tell the stories so well, especially for kids. The problem is that by the age of 4, the children have been so inundated with the same version of these stories over and over and over again, whether it's Disney or a picture book version. In the beginning of my second book, I say, you know, there are all these classrooms where teachers will say, now we're going to hear a Cinderella story from China. Now we're going to hear a Cinderella story from Madagascar. Now we're going to hear a Cinderella story from the moon. And the kids are so bored with the same story over and over and over again. What I want to do is not to discard those earlier versions, but start to show kids that there is another version of those stories, one that in fact they would love, and speaks not to the needs of a 3-year-old as a Disney Cinderella might do, but speaks to the needs of an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old.
So I have to believe that your parents are the ones who turned you on to the Grimm fairy tales in the first place. Did they read these to you as a kid, the original versions?
They didn't. They gave me that book, and that's why I had it on my shelf. But like I said, I literally had never picked it up before or read it. I first became aware of these stories, probably a few different sources. When I was in high school, I was in the musical Into the Woods by Sondheim, Stephen
Sure.
Sondheim, which is a brilliant musical and treats the real Grimm fairy tales. Sondheim took a lot of his inspiration from Bruno Bettelheim. Bruno Bettelheim was a psychologist in the 70s and 80s who, while his treatment was kind of controversial, he wrote an incredible book about fairy tales called The Uses of Enchantment. And The Uses of Enchantment is what inspired Sondheim to write Into the Woods, as I understand it. And after acting in Into the Woods, I read The Uses of Enchantment. And I think that's when I first started getting the idea that these stories were deeper. I then didn't re-encounter them until I was teaching those children, and suddenly it all came back to me, and I realized that telling stories about sisters cutting off pieces of their feet might also be talking about sibling rivalry and guilt and other deep issues that children need to deal with.
All kinds of stuff that's down there that we need to deal with and deal with through the reading of the stories and the grim conclusion. We'll come back and talk more with Adam Gidwitz about his book and all the stuff that goes behind it. We have some phone calls waiting. We'll talk to Adam Gidwitz and you here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Adam Gidwitz, New York Times bestselling author. He's written a trilogy of books in which he repackages the old Grimm Brothers fairy tales and returns them to their original level of gruesomeness, takes out the Disney effect. The third and final book in the trilogy is called The Grimm Conclusion, out in appropriate Halloween colors on bookstore shelves right now. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about children and fairy tales and the level of gruesomeness that we sometimes need. 800-838-3760, our phone number anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley number, 541-552-6782, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So when we were talking about the things that, the emotions that children need to express, and they can see examples of these in the stories that the Grimm brothers told and that you are putting out there as well through the Grimm conclusion, one really struck me early on when Jorinda and Joringel's mother tells them, stuff your tears, don't show them, don't cry. And was that from the Grimms originally, or is that from you?
No, that's from me, and that starts a longer emotional journey that Jorinda will have to go through in the Grimm conclusion, where ultimately, I don't want to give too much away, but ultimately they realize that stuffing your tears down and not crying and covering up your emotions is not the best way to deal with them. In fact, the Grimm conclusion is sort of my statement about why we tell these stories in the first place. When I first wrote a draft of it, I wrote sort of a fast and fun draft without a lot of emotional heft and gave it to my brilliant editor at Penguin. She's a wonderful editor, responsible for authors such as John Green and Ali Condie. And she read that first draft and she said, you know, this is good, but this is the last of the Grimm books. Can you tell us why we've been doing this? Why have we gone through all of this? And so I rewrote the book, and that theme that you just mentioned became front and center, where their mother in the beginning says, push your tears down. And by the end of the book, they realize that the act of telling stories is in fact the most cathartic possible act. Which is, of course, why I probably wrote the books in the first place.
It is something of a lightning bolt when it comes out. It's like, oh my God, she's telling her kids what? But there it is.
Right.
And I have to appreciate the level of glee that you show here in relating some of the most gruesome details. At one point, your narrator's voice says, sorry. Sorry that it's so awesome.
Well, they love it. The kids love it. So I have to apologize for the parents and then have to apologize to the kids for apologizing to
That's a good trick. That's definitely takes some practice. Let's take some calls here. Helga in Ashland, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Gidwitz, the author of The Grimm Conclusion.
Hi, Adam. I just read the Grimm fairy tales in German, and I just pulled the book out of my shelf, and it's written in Gothic script, which I had to also learn how to read. And it struck me what you said about leaving it open to the imagination in the stories is so different from seeing it in a movie. And I keep being struck when I see people put on their Halloween costumes and think they're being Snow White, and I think, oh, so that's not, why does that have to be Snow White? Oh, because you saw the movie, and it's stuck in your mind. And you know,
yeah, absolutely.
It, it was read to us under the willow tree in the summer in Alabama in German. And
amazing, amazing. I wish I had somebody read it to me in German. I wish, in fact, if we had 15 right now, I'd ask you to read one to us in German, but I don't think we have that time.
Yeah, that's okay.
I was thinking about, it's funny that you say seeing those girls dressed up as Snow White for Halloween. I say in my third book, Cinderella or Aschenputtel, when they called her Cinderella, they would have been calling her Cinderella because she was covered with cinders or ashes, in the case of Aschenputtel, because she was cleaning the fireplaces and the chimneys, but also because she was cleaning out the chamber pots. And everybody known that 200 years ago. If you heard that story and you heard that she was covered with cinders and ashes, it was because she was cleaning out the non-flushing toilets. So I always tell kids that next time you see a little girl who's really excited for Halloween, and she says, "I'm going to be Cinderella, I'm going to be Cinderella," what she's actually saying is, "I'm going to be toilet cleaner," which they usually get a kick out of. And then I tell them not to tell the little girl that because she'll probably cry.
Probably. Thanks for the call, Helga. Let's go on to Kurt in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Adam Gidwitz wrote The Grim Conclusion. Kurt, go ahead.
Oh, I didn't hear my name there. Okay, yeah. I'm very familiar with these things. And I have a different interpretation or a different angle. Let me just say, like, for example, Little Red Riding Hood. These are all aspects of one person. There's the grandmother who is the wise and the old person. That's an aspect of oneself. There's the wolf who devours a grandmother, that's the wolf nature of oneself. And then there's the Little Red Riding Hood, the innocent person, an aspect of oneself, and then the hunters that come later and rectify the situation, and that's the will aspect of oneself. So it's...
Are you a psychologist? It sounds like you have psychological training.
So I'm familiar with Bruno Bettelheim's... uses of enchantment, and he had a bit of a Freudian interpretation of these things, but he did go into deeper meaning mm-hmm. of the fairy tales. The language of the fairy tale is close to a dream language, and that's why the children understand it. Now, a dream language is, in the Freudian, rather in the Jungian interpretation of dreams, it's a subjective interpretation rather than an objective. So these aren't external objects, different people. They are internal aspects of oneself.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to understand the fairy tale, you have to understand that. You have to understand the dream language and the profundity of it and the importance of it. And
I really agree with that. I think that you're absolutely right. And I think what's miraculous about these stories is that children don't know that, and yet it works for them on exactly that level. I think whether you say that everything in the story is oneself or is objects that they're relating to, whether you're Freudian or Jungian or we're just interpreting it sort of according to as you see children responding to it, it works not just on one level but on all of those levels for a child at once. And the great thing is the kid doesn't have to know that. In fact, trying to explain that to a child who is enjoying a fairy tale will probably ruin the story for the kid. But they are deeply symbolic, children are, and that dream world is very close to them. And they get everything that, Kirk, you've just been describing on an intuitive level. It reminds me of, if you are familiar with the wonderful book, The Little Prince, at the very beginning he walks around showing everybody a picture of what looks like a brown hat. And every adult says it's a brown hat, and he's furious that nobody realizes it's a boa constrictor that's eaten an elephant. Children, when they're reading these fairy tales, see the brown hat and the boa constrictor that's eaten the elephant at the same time, whether they know it or not.
Kurt, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. We have an email from Linda in Medford just wondering if your guest has watched the Grimm TV show, and if so, what he thinks of its relation to the Grimm fairy tales and the myths of time period when the fairy tales were written.
So I have to be honest and say that I have not seen that or Once Upon a Time because I was trying to keep my interpretation of the Grimm fairy tales as fresh and real as possible. In other words, not interpreted through the TV shows, but just from the book itself. Though, to be honest, people who know the fairy tales tell me that they really like the shows. So I can't speak to that personally.
Do you think that the creation of your trilogy of books might have lent a hand to the creation of the TV shows? I mean, Once Upon a Time and Grimm, and we've got vampires and zombies and all kinds of fun stuff out there now.
It is all lots of fun, and I have a lawsuit pending against all of those TV shows. No, just kidding. I don't think my books have necessarily anything to do with it, but I do think that fairy tales and the fantastic, the gothic, comes back during times that are difficult. I think when we had a big economic boom going on, especially during the Clinton years, you saw a lot of hyper-real stories being written and movies being made because we felt confidence to deal with reality. I think when things start to get more difficult, with the onset of wars and the renewed war on terrorism and depression, economic recession, we tend to want to go into the forest, like in a fairy tale. And we go into the forest away from home to cope with our worries in a different way, in a different guise. And in the forest, we face our fears and we defeat them and we return home armed with that wisdom and strength. That is the form of every fairy tale, but I also think it is the form of reading fairy tales and the form of watching gothic and fantastical shows like Grimm or Once Upon a Time. So I don't think it's coincidence that is all going on right now during this period.
Well, and I was just, the note I made when reading through the stories in the book is that nobody in the story seems to be 100% good. In fact, I'm not sure anybody really gets past about 60%.
True.
Which seems to be the theme, too, with some of these TV shows. Peter Pan, for example, in Once Upon a Time, in the current storyline, he's a bad guy.
Oh, interesting.
Or mostly, anyway. We're not quite sure yet, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say the one thing is that the children in my books are good. They make mistakes, but they are good. And I think that that's important for kids reading the books because children are optimists. They believe that they will grow up, and when they grow up, they will be stronger and better and wiser than they are right now. And so I want my main characters to make mistakes, but I want them to have happy endings and to triumph and survive and come out as good, strong people because that's what children want for themselves. It's one of the things that distinguishes children's literature from adult literature. As many simple ideas as I try to put into my books, it's first and foremost for children because it has that optimism laced through it.
Let us take another call. Brad in Ashland is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Adam Gidwitz, the author of The Grim Conclusion.
Thank you, and thank you, Adam, too. I like to call in and compliment authors when I feel simpatico with their message. But with this, I have the same reaction to him as I did to reading the original Grimm stories and to Quentin Tarantino movies. That this is child abuse to teach them such frightful, mean, cruel things. They learn that this is part of our drama, that this is how the life is, and they grow up with an injured amygdala that's reactive. I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think children are working out their stuff through this stuff. I think it's very dangerous business that we model stuff that ends up becoming replicated in our society, and our society is becoming increasingly violent.
All right. Well, we'll pick it up from there. Thanks for the call, Brad.
I think it's really interesting. I think that is something that I hear from parents and certain adults around the country from time to time. And I think it's a valid point of view that's worth discussing. Having shared these stories with thousands and thousands of children, that's not what I see. And having taught kids for 8 years, that's not what I see either. I once had a girl who was suffering from insomnia, and we couldn't figure out why. She was really coming in sleep-deprived and upset every morning. And I eventually brought in the parent and asked her if anything was going on at home. And they described their pre-bed ritual, and it involved watching the 11 o'clock news.
Oh.
The news is deeply traumatizing to children because terrifying things happen, and they seem to be dangerous to kids, and they are dangerous. Fairy tales are not like that. Fairy tales start with Once Upon a Time, and children know that. So if the most recent caller tried to tell with, the light spirit that I think the fairy tales have, one of these stories to an 8 or a 10 or let's say a 10 or a 12 year old that he knew and started with Once Upon a Time and ended with Happily Ever After, I think he would be surprised to find the way the children reacted to them. I was in high school one day, and I was in the hallway, and I had A Tale Dark and Grim had just come out, and a third-grade girl came up to me, a very quiet little girl, and I'd never spoken to her before, but I knew her by reputation. And she came up to me, and she said, "Did you write that Grimm book?" And I said, "I did." And she threw her little arms around my neck, and she hugged me so tightly, and then she ran away. And to say that kids aren't reacting in positive ways to these stories, I think, doesn't acknowledge the evidence of what I see and what I think many child psychologists and teachers see when they share these stories.
So, Adam Gidwitz, is this it for the Grimm books? I mean, can you be talked out of a retirement, turn the trilogy into a quadrilogy or something?
I think I am going to put the Grimm books down for the moment, but I promise I will write more funny, scary books in the future. My wife is actually a professor of medieval history here in Brooklyn, and I intend my next books to be take place in the Middle Ages. I just read a wonderful story from, I think, right around 1200 about a dragon that kills people by farting on them. So I think that's going to have to feature prominently in my next work.
And I think it'll appeal to some of the same readers who've been reading the Grimm tales in your trilogy.
I certainly hope so.
Conclusion is the latest book in the series of three from Adam Gidwitz. He's had a lot of fun with the Brothers Grimm and their fairy tales. Adam Gidwitz, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
So much for having me. It was
a pleasure. That'll do it for today's exchange. You'll find out more about our program and subjects, and you can suggest guests as well at jeffexchange.org. We also provide show topics and recordings on our Facebook page, with the same links available on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, The Takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, we'll be followed by news from the BBC. Tomorrow on The Exchange, First Friday in the Arts, we will take up a list of items in the arts world coming up for the next several weeks in our region. Please call in and let us know about more events. We'll talk about a coming health fair to the Rogue Valley. And then we'll talk to the author of the book Hardwiring Happiness about why it is that the bad experiences seem to stick with us and how we can actually change our brain wiring to move that thing around. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duran. I'm Jeffrey Riley. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. Have a great day.